Welcome to this special edition of the Lena Live Radio Hour, hosted by Professor Lena Miermond and myself, producer Julian Lampert. Our guest is Sir Richard Roberts, the biochemist and molecular biologist who, in 1993, together with Dr. Philip Alan Sharp, earned the Nobel Prize in Medicine. Originally from Derby, England, Sir Richard Roberts earned his PhD in chemistry from the University of Sheffield, and at Harvard University he conducted his postdoctoral research in the laboratory of Dr. Jack Strominger. He is the chief scientific officer of New England Biolabs in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Sir Richard is also distinguished professor at Northeastern University and serves as distinguished scientist at Boston University. Our conversation with Sir Richard took us to Harvard Square, the heart of Cambridge, Massachusetts, and we are grateful to Nancy Shirer for generously offering the space at the Harvard Coop, where we spoke with Sir Richard. We were greatly honored with this opportunity to speak with Sir Richard for one particular reason, actually, which is that Sir Richard continues a kind of distinguished lineage, a heritage of atheist scientists. It's a kind of quirky designation, but an extremely significant one when we remember figures such as Charles Darwin, Ludwig Boltzmann, and Albert Einstein, who were staunch atheists. In more modern times, we have the great physicists Peter Higgs and Leonard Susskind, also atheists. So why the emphasis on atheism? My great-grandfather, the late Dr. Felix Lampert, was a fiercely atheistic individual. He was a prominent cancer surgeon in the Soviet Union at that time, and his atheism did not prevent him from writing that when he first heard the B minor Mass by Bach, he felt as if his heart was ripped out of his chest. Imagine music written by devout Christians, interpreted by atheists. It almost seems like an absurd picture, and yet this is one of the most significant chapters in music history, since there were scores of listeners who would leave the concert halls with tears in their eyes after listening to such artists as Vladimir Horowitz and Emil Gilels, who were passionate atheists. Perhaps atheists have a more direct contact with the world and are thus able to transmit their own convictions with that same directness or realness, if you will. This was certainly our impression after speaking with Sir Richard Roberts. It is for this reason that we came away from our conversation with Sir Richard feeling not only fascinated, but deeply moved. Here is Sir Richard Roberts, the 1993 Nobel Laureate for Medicine, in conversation with us in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
My first question will be directed to DNA sequences. What is the nature of it? And what is the point of your particular interest in that?
Well, you know, DNA sequence is the basis of life. This is the genetic material, the material that decides what an organism ultimately is going to be, because it encodes all of the genes that ultimately make you and I what we are, or makes a bacteria what it is, makes a tree what it is, and so on. And it's only since about 1977 or so that we've been able to actually determine big DNA sequences. We got the human genome around just after 2000, although even today it's hard to say that we really know the complete sequence of the human genome, because there are many repetitive parts of it that are difficult to decipher completely. But we have a pretty good idea of what the human genome looks like. My own favorite organisms are bacteria. For bacteria, it is much easier to determine DNA sequences. The organisms themselves have a very small genome, which is what we call the DNA, typically anywhere from 1 to about 8-9 million base pairs. So 1 million to 9 million individual nucleotides go in to make up the genome. And as a result of that, there are many less genes. There may be of the order of somewhere between 2,000 and 6,000 genes in a typical bacterium. And we can determine the sequence exactly. We know exactly what is there. And so this makes it much easier to then study them, because once you know what genes are there, then you know what it is you have to explain as a scientist in terms of how it works. It's like having a car. If I give you the blueprint and say these are all the parts of the car, then those are the only parts that you have to explain when you're trying to tell someone how that car works. And so it's the same thing for an organism.
I appreciate the simplicity of your explanation with the relationship of what we know. I like to ask you about this prokaryotic genes.
Mm-hmm.
Correct me if I'm wrong, that they've been discovered as a consequence of your studying DNA sequences?
No, I can't claim credit for that. So, you know, genes have been known for a long time. So it was really, you have to go back to the early geneticists like Mendel, who were aware that there must be units of heredity that were called genes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it became apparent that there were stretches of sequence that were genes. People came up with the idea that one gene encoded one enzyme, and so for each gene there was a corresponding biochemical activity that went to make the whole organism.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't until 1953 when Watson and Crick really discovered the structure of DNA.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, it suddenly became clear that here was the basis of the genetic material, and that if we could go on and understand it, understand how it was decoded, because it was clear there was a code there, then we should be able to make progress in terms of learning how life actually worked. If you like, the chemistry of life, which is something that, with my background as a chemist, I'm very interested in. And so following that, there was a period where people realized that there was a linear relationship between the DNA and the proteins that were made. And in that way, it was realized that you could read the bases three at a time. And in that way, each three bases would code for one amino acid, which went into a protein, and a protein was just a collection of amino acids. It's called the genetic code. And so that was very exciting during the 1960s when they were deciphering the genetic code and working out what it all meant. And during that time, too, it was realized that there was an intermediate step between the DNA and the protein, that there was another molecule called RNA, messenger RNA, which really carried the message from the DNA into a complicated structure called a ribosome that then went on to make the protein. And so once that was determined, people were very interested in getting some sequence information, working out what were the actual sequences that were present. And that took place really between about 1967, 68, through to 77, where people worked out, and notably Fred Sanger, worked out methods for determining RNA sequence. So it turned out it was easier to determine the sequences of RNA than it was of DNA. And so he went on and did that. And on the basis of that, we started to get an idea of what a gene was. And the conventional idea of a gene came from work that was done on bacteriophages, that is viruses that infect bacteria, not on the bacteria themselves because they were a little large. And then from that, it was clear that each gene that people were studying corresponded to a segment of DNA, and you started reading the DNA at one particular point, which we called a promoter. And then that went on until you got to a terminator, and that made a single piece of RNA. That piece of RNA was read three bases at a time by the ribosome, and that would then code for a protein. So if you had an RNA that was 900 nucleotides long, then that could code for a protein of 300 amino acids, so 3 to 1. Three nucleotides make one amino acid. And so that was all very exciting. And it was felt pretty universally that all organisms work this way, that the DNA, you would copy it into RNA, you would read the RNA three bases at a time and make protein. And in 1977, what I discovered and Phil Sharp did at the same time independently, was that in fact it wasn't quite like that in all organisms, that that worked well for bacteria, but it didn't work for higher organisms. And that in higher organisms, instead of the gene just being a single 900 nucleotide long piece, it was actually split into a lot of smaller pieces, maybe a 200 piece and then a 100 and then another 100 further down, but there was a lot of nucleotides in between that didn't code for protein. And this became known as split genes or RNA splicing, and the bits that coded for protein became known as exons. The bits that didn't became known as introns. And so this was a huge difference between bacteria and higher organisms in the way in which they actually made protein. And it was all in the processing of the RNA that was a big difference there.
And these prokaryotic genes, what are the role of those?
Well, they do exactly the same that your genes do. So okay. Everybody's
But they're
genes.
Missing something.
No, they're not.
Don't they miss some kind of a membranes?
No, not at all. So one of the differences between, if you want to look at the differences between bacteria and eukaryotes, then bacteria do not have the DNA captured inside the nucleus. So eukaryotes, most of them, not all, have the DNA kept in a special vesicle inside the cell called the nucleus, and that's where the DNA is located. Bacteria don't have that, but nevertheless, they have a bacterial membrane and they have a cell wall, but the DNA is free within the cytoplasm, or freer within the cytoplasm. It's actually coated in proteins in something called a nucleoid body, but it's not a special organ like the nucleus, which we have in higher organisms.
Life and non-life are made of atoms, and as far as I understand it, the atoms in an organism and atoms that is not an organic material are identical.
Mm-hmm.
Hydrogen, for
right.
example.
Yeah.
Why could we not consider this to be alive?
Well, basically the difference is something is thought to be alive when it is able to replicate itself. And so this desk cannot replicate itself, but something that is alive can replicate itself.
I see.
The difficulty sometimes comes with viruses. So viruses are not capable of replicating by themselves in a test tube. They need a cell in order to replicate, and so they need some of the machinery that is in the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically we don't think of viruses as being alive, but we think of bacteria as being alive,
mm-hmm.
because we can take a bacterium and maybe put it on a culture dish and just feed it a few chemicals, and it will grow and divide and make more bacteria. So for me, that is as good a definition of life as you can have. It is self-replicating. It's able to replicate itself.
So then it must be an almost inconceivable miracle that the very same substances, the same atoms, in an environment which is non-life,
mm-hmm.
would come together in this incredible way to create life.
Yes.
It's not like the atoms are different.
Right. We actually don't know how unlikely it is that something like that would happen. I'm a staunch atheist, so I don't like
yes.
the word miracle.
Yes.
But it is conceivable that any time you get a planet that has the same kind of chemicals in it, has the same kind of environment, has water, that maybe life spontaneously arises at quite a reasonable rate.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really makes life work is the process of evolution. And that is, you can imagine something very simple being able to replicate itself. And once you have that and start to make mutants and then select for things that can replicate better, then you have a selection process in place that will make sure that life not only will continue, but will actually divide and become very different kinds of forms, so that we see all of the kinds of forms that are around us here.
Mm-hmm.
And so what we don't know is just what is the minimal replicating unit that it would be necessary to form to get life started, if you like,
mm-hmm.
to sort of jump start it. And that was something that happened on Earth many billions of years ago. And we don't know. We have some traces of what it might be, but we don't have a way of actually reproducing it ourselves at the moment. But some of my colleagues are trying to reproduce it. So, for instance, Jack Szostak down at Mass General Hospital is trying to get life started.
Yeah.
Let's take a brief break for a word from one of our supporters, Calvary Hospital.
Dear Calvary Hospital, my dad was at the end of his life, suffering from pancreatic cancer. I knew there was only one place that could relieve his pain and ours as well, Calvary Hospital. His wish was to die at home, so it was Calvary Home Hospice that provided Dad with the quality of life he deserved, filled with exceptional comfort and warmth. He passed on with dignity and grace, and we were all there with him. A year later, my mom needed the same Calvary care. And once again, Calvary's expert home hospice staff was there for us. My parents gave me unqualified love their entire lives. There was no better way for me to return this love than with Calvary's care. Yours truly, Deborah DiGregorio.
This is Frank Calamari, president of Calvary Hospital. Our world-renowned hospice program brings our expert end-of-life care right into your home. Call us at 718-518-2465.
You can also find Calvary Hospital online at www.calvaryhospital.org. That's Calvary Hospital, all one word, .org. You're listening to a special edition of the Lena Live Radio Hour with our guest, Sir Richard Roberts, the 1993 Nobel Laureate for Medicine, as well as the Chief Science Officer of New England Biolabs in Ipswich, Massachusetts. Sir Richard is also Distinguished Professor at Northeastern University in Boston.
Why did RNA survive DNA?
Because it's not, DNA is much less accessible than RNA. So it's not easy to work with DNA. If I took DNA and said, well, I want to get at the message, first of all, you've got to decide which strand you're going to use. And so that would be a problem. But then you'd have to separate the strands and now put that into some kind of synthesizing apparatus, which means you would have to re-evolve all of the machinery that was already in place that used RNA.
I see.
Right, so it's, I think evolution, you know, there was a man called Dobzhansky who said that all of biology only makes sense in light of evolution. If you ignore evolution, then biology doesn't make any sense at all. It's just way too complicated, as you said at the start. But as soon as you start to look back into the evolutionary origins of everything, then you can see how this mechanism got fixed.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the nice thing about evolution is that nature comes up with some new way of doing something, right? And if that is more successful, if the life form is more successful than what was there before disappears and the new life form takes over.
And you can just take that down to the molecular level, and exactly the same thing happens. If you've got something that works at the molecular level, and then something else comes along that's better, then it will replace it. But once you've got a degree of complexity going on, you can only make small changes. You can't make massive changes so easily. Mm-hmm. And so when DNA came along and was adopted as the genetic material, then it became much more difficult to think of all the changes you would have to make and how those could be selected for if you were going to then use DNA instead of RNA as the message.
Is DNA the same in terms of its content for all life forms?
Well, chemically it's the same, but if you look at a polymer, the thing that is the essence of DNA is the order of the four bases.
Yes.
So A, C, G, T.
Yeah.
So that is the thing, that order is the thing that differs from one life form to another. Now, there are very often segments of it, which we call genes, that code for specific things that can be the same all the way across many, many organisms, all the way through life pretty much in some cases. Right? Because this is something that has worked, right? So as soon as evolution finds something that works and works really well, then there's a lot of pressure to keep it. And if you first invent something and it only partially works, then evolution, the mutations that come along, mean that the things that don't work as well will disappear, and the things that work best will stay. And so when you've got proteins that are absolutely, so they do something that's absolutely essential for life, they tend not to pick up a lot of mutations. They tend to stay. They tend to be the same.
The evolution into DNA, do we have an idea, more or less, of when that occurred?
No. Maybe somebody does. I don't. Okay. So you would have to go and ask an evolutionist who might be able to tell you when that occurred. We can make some guesses as to how it occurred.
Mm-hmm.
So for instance...
That was my next question.
Okay. So, you know, you imagine you have RNA as the genetic material and also the message. Okay. For it to be the genetic material, you have to copy it. And so you have an enzyme, RNA polymerase, that will copy it and make an exact copy, and then you've got double-stranded RNA, and now the strands can separate, and you can make more, and you have your replication going.
Mm-hmm.
That enzyme that copies RNA, if by chance it became mutant and could make DNA instead of RNA, that is, it just uses DATP instead of ATP, or DGTP, deoxy-GTP instead of ribo-GTP, then you could imagine an easy mechanism for making DNA. Now, it's still a long way to go before you get to something that is replicative and useful, but we already know of enzymes that will copy RNA and make DNA. We call them reverse transcriptases, right? So this is the reason why Howard Temin and David Baltimore won the Nobel Prize for discovering this particular enzyme. And these things we know are quite old. We know, for instance, that in order for HIV to become integrated into the human genome, as it does when it infects you, you use reverse transcriptase. You use an enzyme that makes a DNA copy, and then that DNA copy can recombine into the genome. And so we already have plenty of examples out there of this process in action at the moment, of how you can start with an RNA, because HIV is an RNA virus, how you can copy it into DNA, you can make double-stranded DNA, you can integrate that into a piece of DNA in the human genome, and then it preserves the virus. And so you can imagine that when you were first making DNA as the genetic material, that some process akin to that was the way in which you made the first pieces of double-stranded DNA, and that eventually nature figured out how to use them in order to then make messenger RNA and then go through the whole business of making something stable as the genetic material, and then just using this ephemeral RNA, messenger RNA, to actually go to the ribosome and code for proteins.
This evolution from RNA to DNA,
right,
it all still occurred when life on Earth was on a cellular level.
Yes.
Not ever known. So it's not possible.
Cells were already there.
Yeah. There were no animals of
No, they
RNA.
It almost certainly happened when bacteria and the precursors to bacteria were around.
Yeah.
Which is long, long time ago.
In terms of your, I have some other questions about genes, but I wanted to ask you about your work and
mm-hmm.
what earned you the Nobel Prize. I frankly didn't understand
uh-huh.
the explanation, and I specifically wanted to ask you also what an intron is.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't understand the definition of that.
So I can try. I think a good way to sort of think about it is to use the analogy to make in a movie. Right? So if you look at a piece of DNA in a bacterium, then there is a linear reading of that DNA. So you start at base 1, you read along to, say, base 300, you decode it 3 bases at a time, which makes 100 amino acids, and then you have your protein.
Mm-hmm.
In eukaryotes, that is not what happens, at least in anything that is more than a very primitive eukaryote. So in the higher organisms, that gene, instead of being just 100 long, making a protein 100 long from a 300 nucleotide stretch, actually has inside it a gap. It's got a whole stretch of DNA that is copied into RNA so that the whole gene may become 600 bases long, and the first 150 perhaps code for the first 50 amino acids of this protein. And then there is a gap of some sequence. It's DNA, it's there, but it's not a part of the final protein. And then at the 3' end, at the far end, there's another batch of 150 nucleotides that code for 50 amino acids. And so what happens is that you make the whole thing. So you make the 600 long piece of RNA, and then you cut and splice so that the 150 nucleotides at one end and the 150 at the other become joined, and the 300 in the middle that are not part of the coding sequence just get lost. They get thrown away. Okay? In general, we don't know what happens to them, but just they get thrown away. So in a bacterium, you just read straight through for 300 nucleotides, and put it into the ribosome and makes a protein. In eukaryotes, the thing may be 600 long. You take 150 from here, 150 from here, you throw out the 300 in the middle, join these two together, and then it looks exactly like a piece of RNA that might have come from a bacterium, and you put it in the ribosome and away it makes a protein. And that was what I discovered, that there were these pieces in the middle of genes that had to be thrown away in order to accurately make the messenger RNA that you wanted to then send it off to the ribosome.
Oh, I see.
Okay. And the movie analogy is, the film producer comes along, the director comes along, takes a whole clip, then takes another scene, and now he gets on the editing floor and cuts out the bit that he needs and joins it to this bit over here that he needs, throws away all the stuff on the sides, and so you end up with a nice coherent picture coming out of it. And that's what nature does to RNA.
Yes, I was going to ask you whether that's a natural process.
Yes.
Or that's a...
Yeah, this is what happens in every cell in your body all the time.
Is it something that can be replicated in the laboratory?
Yes. But it turns out it's a very, very complicated process. So when we discovered splicing in 1977, we tried the following year to begin to replicate it. We wanted to get a system so that we could do the same thing in a test tube, so that we could study and find out what all the components were.
Yeah.
And we failed miserably. Several other groups tried and failed, but one group started to make some progress, actually a guy at Harvard, Tom Maniatis. And then he went on, we got out of the business, we didn't do it anymore. But even today, we know most of what is involved, but we don't know everything about it. and it is quite difficult still to do it really effectively in vitro, because it's a multi-protein complex. It's even more complicated than the ribosome in order to do this. Mm-hmm. Many, many proteins involved.
What accounts for that gap in the middle?
So there are two views. One view says that when RNAs were first being made, when you were first making genes, the genes were actually not 100 amino acids worth all at once. So, you know, if you imagine by chance you want to make something that is a nice gene coding for 100 long protein, the chances of just making 300 nucleotides that just code for this protein pretty low. Mm-hmm. And so one view is that the original genes were actually already in pieces, that you would make a little bit and copy it, and then make another little bit and copy it, and these were getting joined, and that this process of splicing is actually quite old. The argument against that is that, well, the apparatus to do it is really very complicated. But that's not to say that you couldn't imagine a simpler way of doing it that just wasn't very accurate. That, mm-hmm. you know, so you would do it, and maybe 1 out of 100 of these RNAs that you made were ones that were useful, but if they worked, then you would select for them. Mm-hmm. And then the other view is, well, everything originally was all in one piece, and that this idea that you could put extra DNA in between for whatever reason, maybe to control expression or to have some regulatory function, this came later, and that it was at that point that you then started to make the apparatus in order to do it. I don't mm-hmm. like that so much. I like the idea that the genes originally were actually rather small. Even in bacteria, the original genes were probably not just this 100 or 300 long piece. They were probably a little bit here, and then you'd pass something, and then a little bit here, and maybe the transcription, the polymerase that was making the RNA, maybe it would skip from one to another, or maybe it would make stuff and then stuff would get lost by chance, or maybe the ribosomes were not very accurate and they go along and stop and pause and then pick up after a little way and go on. We really don't know. But that's a way where you can see how all of this could have evolved. So I think it's easy to see if, let's say I have a 400 long piece of DNA, and within it I've got 300 nucleotides that actually code for what I want, but I've got a very sloppy system for sort of saying where I start and where I continue, and then I come to a little bit and I jump and go somewhere else. You can sort of see how that could become more streamlined. That is something that, as nature got better at doing it, the organisms that did it better would survive because they'd replicate faster.
Yes.
So I like personally the idea that introns are very old. The bits that get thrown out are called introns. The bits that are saved are called exons. I also think that there has been late acquisition of introns too. So there have been times when extra pieces have been put in during the evolution of a particular gene, maybe because it made something more efficient, or maybe it didn't really matter because sort of the junctions, those bits that had to be joined, were already so well defined, you could put another piece in between, it wouldn't matter. And I think there is quite good evidence that in some cases, some of these introns arrive late. And so you probably have a mix of both mechanisms, that originally things were in pieces and slowly worked their way together. But later on, it was found advantageous, nature found it advantageous, to put extra pieces of DNA in. And in the example I gave you, I'm talking about just one intron being put in between two exons. But when we look at genes, we find very often there are 5, 10, 15, 50 of these introns that have been put into the genes. So the genes get to be very complicated in many eukaryotic cells.
If the introns are put in, then why are they still considered as introns?
Well, if they get put in and they're not translated,
they're not translated.
So, you know, again, go back to the simple thing. So I've got 150 nucleotides here, 150 nucleotides over here, 300 in between, right? The 300 in between are nonsense. Doesn't matter what they are, it's the 150 on both sides that are important. If I take another piece of nonsense and put it in the middle of the 300, maybe it doesn't matter. If there's a good way of joining, if we know the signals that tell us where to join the 250s, you can imagine putting stuff anywhere in the middle. It won't matter. It won't affect it.
I see.
So there is a mechanism that will allow that. And we know that there are plenty of pieces of DNA in human cells, in all eukaryotes, called transposons, that can move from one place to another. In fact, we have loads of these things in our genomes. And if you're not careful, they spread.
Often
they will just amplify themselves. So very often they will make a copy, and that copy will go and jump into something else. And so a lady that I used to know very well at Cold Spring Harbor Lab when I was there, Barbara McClintock, she discovered this back in the 1940s. And it was work that was just forgotten. Okay, nobody believed it. She was the only person who, I think, really believed it. But later on, it was rediscovered, and people went back and looked at what she'd done, and she was absolutely correct. She worked the whole thing out. And so she won the Nobel Prize back in the 1980s for that discovery. A very remarkable lady.
She won the prize 40 years after having...
Yes, right.
As I mentioned before, your science is a tremendous, endless world. We just had fantastic panoramic journey. You led us into some most complicated process, and I'm going to repeat myself and thank you for saying that it was as clear as one can imagine, as transparent and as humanly understandable possible. So I'm very, very grateful for that. And from our listeners, that's particularly very special. Thanks. Who is the person behind, and as I said, in front of that science? Mm-hmm. Whatever you choose to share with us, we will be very, very appreciative.
Well, I have a lot of curiosity. I wonder how things work. I started life getting interested in science by making fireworks. I loved explosions. I loved sending fireworks up in the sky. I thought that was good. And I always thought I was going to become a chemist, and chemistry was the thing I would want to do. But when I was doing my PhD, I discovered biology, if you like. I discovered molecular biology. And I read a book by a man called John Kendrew called The Thread of Life that described the origins of molecular biology, where it had all come from. And so on the basis of that, I decided this was what I wanted to do. I knew by the time I finished that book that molecular biology was what I wanted to do with my life. So when it came time to do a postdoc, I applied to a number of labs that were not actually doing molecular biology, but were close. They were doing biological chemistry of one sort and another. And everybody turned me down except for one man in Wisconsin, Jack Strominger. And he offered me a fellowship, which I took. And just before I was scheduled to go to Wisconsin, he wrote to me and said, "Can you wait a couple of months? Because I'm just moving to Harvard and you should come and join me in Harvard." So that's how I got to Harvard, quite by chance. Spent 4 years at Harvard. And during that time, I learned about RNA sequencing. I learned how to sequence RNA. And I became fascinated by sequences because these were clearly, you know, the origins of biology. If you want to understand how biology works, then you need to know the sequence of the DNA that is underlying everything. And so then I went down to Cold Spring Harbor Lab, which is the lab on Long Island where Jim Watson was, mm-hmm. was director mm-hmm. at the time. Mm-hmm. Started a lab there. I had imagined that what I would be doing would be to develop methods for sequencing DNA because there were no methods available at the time. People could sequence RNA, but they couldn't sequence DNA.
You're listening to Sir Richard Roberts, the 1993 Nobel laureate for medicine. Let's take our final break for a message from one of our supporters, Calvary Hospital.
Dear Calvary Hospital, James Lee was a true hero. Saving lives was something he always wanted to do, whether as a paratrooper for the 82nd Airborne or as a New York City fireman. They called him Jimmy. I was proud to call him Dad. But when terminal illness ravaged his body, this man's man knew that this was one life that could not be saved. Not even by me, an experienced nurse. It just wasn't fair that he had to suffer like this. But then Calvary stepped in. You relieved his enormous pain and not only gave him the peace and comfort he deserved, but you also gave me and my family a chance to enjoy his final days, smiling and laughing, together one last time. How can we ever forget what you mean to us? Yours truly, Colleen Lee.
This is Frank Calamari, president of Calvary Hospital, where life continues. Call us at 718-518-2000. Thank you.
Welcome back to this special edition of the Lena Live Radio Hour with our guest, Sir Richard Roberts, who won the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 1993.
What interested me the most in high school biology, mm-hmm. and it actually, I mean, now I'm obviously not doing that, but it's something that really, really, really fascinates me, is the mechanism of self-preservation, mm-hmm. the instinct of self-preservation. And actually, you already answered this question from your previous answers, but more specifically, what is it about genes that accounts for their resistance to being destroyed? So it's not just that life happened on Earth. Not only did it happen, mm-hmm. but it has persisted. And as you said, when nature would fix something that was broken, the tendency is for that to not continue to be broken. Mm-hmm. And what is it about genes that is so powerful that makes it
genes code for proteins. I mean, they code for other things too, but let's say, look at a gene, codes for a protein.
Yeah.
Okay. If that protein is absolutely essential, so, you know, you're eating grain all the time and you need to break it down, the mm-hmm. protein, the enzyme that is breaking down that grain is a key part of you. If you lose it, if it goes wrong and won't work anymore, you're going to die. And so things that stop working die out. We don't see them. What gets selected are the things that work. And then if you've got something that works a little bit better, slowly it will take over. Slowly it will take over. And the other thing that happens is, instead of thinking just about genes, you think about DNA. So when you're copying DNA, the cellular machinery can make mistakes.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Yeah. Because there's something I don't understand. I didn't know there was a difference between genes and DNA. What is the difference?
Well, a gene is a part of the DNA. And a gene is encoded in the DNA. If I take a long string of DNA, there's a gene here and a gene here and a gene here and a gene here. These are little blocks within the DNA that code for proteins or RNAs or other things. So the gene isn't the whole thing. The gene is just a separate part of it that codes for proteins.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Sorry. Okay. Yeah.
So what happens is when DNA is replicating, it makes mistakes. It also picks up damage from the environment, you know, UV rays, X-rays, all sorts of things can damage DNA. And what's happened over time is that nature has selected for proteins that can repair damaged DNA. And so this is another way. If there were no such mechanisms, then the mutation rate would be incredibly high. And so in the early days, when life was getting going, the mutation rate was unbelievably high. But then slowly organisms figured out how not to do that anymore, how to repair all of these lesions that were coming along. So you pick up a lot of damage to the DNA in your cells every day, but you have enzymes that repair it. If you have a mutant enzyme, or you have an enzyme that goes wrong in some way and doesn't work so well, this is very often how you get cancer. So one of the key drivers of cancer is mutations in the proteins that are normally responsible for repairing damaged DNA. Okay? Because when they go wrong, the damage persists, and then sometimes you end up with cells that proliferate when they shouldn't, they've lost the signals that they need in order to behave correctly, and so then they go on and make cancer. So most of the genes involved in DNA repair, when they go wrong, when they pick up mutations, or if you inherit a mutant gene from your parents, then you're more susceptible to cancer as a result of that.
So it's the repair mechanism that is primarily responsible for the endurance for the...
Yes. Yeah, this is the one thing that makes DNA, it adds to the endurance of DNA. It makes it much better genetic material, makes it more stable.
You mentioned in the beginning there were many, many mutations.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that interesting in itself, that that it could have been the case that life was born on Earth and there were very minimal mutations and life could have been gone quickly after?
Well, and that may have happened to the original life. We don't know. Right? We can't go back in time and check what was going on when life was first evolving. So we don't know. But I think it is an inherent feature of life as it exists on this planet that mutations occur. And if you think about it, everything makes mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, right? And, you know, there is no such thing. Even you go to an automotive factory where they're busy making on a great big pipeline cars. Every so often something goes wrong. One of the machines goes wrong, it screws things up, and then they have to replace it and start all over again. And chemistry is no different. Chemistry is exactly the same. So whenever you're involved in chemical reactions, there are always things that go on that just for random reasons.
The term mutation,
though,
is not just about a change for the worse, it can also be...
Oh, absolutely. For the better, yes. Mutation just means a change.
A change.
Yes, change in the DNA sequence. Yeah. Most are bad, but some are good. And the good ones are the ones that get selected and then go on and lead to new species in some cases, or species that resemble the old one but are just a lot more fit.
The double helix form. What is it? Why did nature select this very intricate form for DNA's structure?
Well,
what is it about that structure?
I mean, it's a very stable structure, and it immediately allows you to replicate the DNA. So because you have two strands, okay, they run in anti-parallel directions. And so if you've got an A on one strand, there's a T on the other. And so as soon as you pull the strands apart and copy them, now you've got the same two strands back again. And so it turns out that it's just a beautiful way of allowing the genetic material to be replicated.
So it's the quickest and most efficient way for it to be replicated?
Well, it is an efficient way to do it. Whether it's the quickest or not, I don't know. I mean, you might imagine that there would be other ways of doing it, but this was the one that nature fixated upon. So you have to remember, almost everything that happens during the course of evolution is chance. Okay? So there's a mutation and something works. If it works really well, then it gets fixed. And now it's difficult to do something else. So yes, as organisms get more and more complicated, it becomes more and more difficult for them to make drastic changes. They can make little changes, but you can't easily make drastic changes. So this is a good example where something got fixed a long time ago. It's unlikely that some alternative form would now get fixed and would take over, but if it could be, then it would. But we have so many enzymes and so many proteins and so many things that depend on DNA that you've got a lot of things you would have to change if you were going to go to something else as the genetic material. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So when you say that they're anti-parallel...
Mm-hmm. Well, a strand of DNA has an orientation. Okay, so we have something which we call the 5' end. We have something called the 3' end. So you start at one end, you look down it, and it has an orientation. So the two strands of the double helix, one runs this way, one runs the other way. So they run exactly opposite to one another.
Opposite, and not only opposite, but
complementary. Yeah.
Each other.
Well, they sort of, you know, yeah, they fold up into a double helix.
I see. Incredible.
Hmm. It is. It's pretty cool.
Lovely. Gadget. Oh, this most
yes.
Marvelous.
That was Sir Richard Roberts, a 1993 Nobel laureate for medicine, a molecular biologist and biochemist who is the chief science officer of New England Biolabs in Ipswich, Massachusetts, as well as distinguished professor at Northeastern University. We are grateful to our supporters, Calvary Hospital, and more recently to DPA Microphones, that's Danish Pro Audio. We're greatly honored to be working with DPA, and it is thanks to their microphones that you, our listeners from all around the world, can hear our voices and our music. Our programs are recorded, mixed, and mastered by Seth Mintz of New York. Please join us next week as we speak to Dr. David Gallo of the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution and CNN commentator. We'll speak to Dr. Gallo about fish, people, and life. Until then, I'm Julian Lambert.
you.